Well, I thought I'd talk tonight really about some kind of approaches to practice, approaches to meditation. I'm so often asked questions about how to meditate properly, and a lot of times the questions are about how to control our mind, and I'm often finding myself needing to sort of explain that mindfulness isn't so much about controlling or suppressing the mind, but really observing the mind, and then responding to that, responding to what we see. Because what we tend to do is just kind of react to things that we feel or react to thoughts unconsciously or automatically. And so mindfulness, you know, helps us to develop this capacity to be with our experience, to be less agitated by the things that arise in our lives, and in our minds, and in our bodies. I'm going to turn this off so I can unzip. All right, sorry. Public speaking makes the body temperature go up. And I also, you know, there's a sort of idea of what's it mean to be good at meditating, or to put it more in spiritual terms, what does mastery of meditation mean? And I think we often imagine that a meditation master, is somebody who's sitting in complete peace, maybe bliss, or their mind is just off in some other realm. And there may be people like that. I've never met any of them. And the people who I consider to be masters are people who are able to be with anything that arises in the mind. And they have ways of responding to what shows up in the mind. They know how to navigate the different mind states. I use this term, the coming to understand the landscape of our mind. And so, I'm often kind of searching for ways to talk about this and explain this. And of course, it's always helpful when I find something that in the Buddhist text that kind of gives a version of this. And so I came upon an interesting piece recently. And it's out of one of what's called the commentaries. So just for a little, inside baseball, as they say about Buddhism. I don't know if you can be inside Buddhist baseball, but what that would mean, I guess, just being really mindful when you're striking out, in my case, anyway. So the earliest Buddhist texts come out of what's called the Pali Canon. Many of you know this already, but for those who are newly initiates, the Pali Canon are texts that were compiled very early on, soon after the Buddha's death. They're preserved orally for a long time, and then after a couple hundred years written down. But later on, there was also this tradition called the commentaries. The commentaries are kind of interesting because a lot of them actually some of them came up soon after the Buddha died as well, but they were kind of considered, we don't need to keep that. It's not like the main point of the text. It's kind of like sometimes there are side stories, like they'll tell like the background or the backstory of a certain sutta. And sometimes they are kind of expanding on the teachings. But they're kind of held as having a great deal of weight in Buddhist teachings. They're not just kind of, oh, there's these extra things. They're really considered central to the teachings, particularly in Theravadan Buddhism, where insight meditation comes from. So the most famous of these is the what's called the Visuddhimagga, which means the path of purification. It was compiled around 500 AD or Common Era. But there are other commentaries, and one of them, which is where I found this particular teaching, is out of the commentaries on the Sutta Nipata. And so the Sutta Nipata is another collection of suttas, but it kind of comes with these commentaries on the suttas. So that's the inside story, where this kind of comes from. And I say that, and I want to frame that partly because these commentaries are often very dry and almost academic, and they also kind of, from our viewpoint, they might just leave out kind of glaring things that we'd be like, well, what about this? You know, so they're not the last word on the teachings, but they can often give something kind of, oh yeah, like a good kind of start to get into a topic. So this particular commentary actually is on the Sutta on Loving Kindness, but it begins by giving a kind of overview of a whole variety of meditation practices. And it's structured around the different temperaments, it says. So people's different temperaments. So it's suggesting different meditation practices for people with different temperaments, which I think right away is kind of intriguing, and I like that idea. And again, it comes to what I, when I think of, again, mastery of meditation, it's kind of, it's not, oh, there's one way to meditate, which is often, you know, this kind of idea. Well, what's the best way to meditate? But this understanding that, oh, well, for different people, different practices are going to be more effective. So now, and this is, again, in the spirit of Buddhism, which is that we're very much on our own, you know, in terms of our practice. You know, the Buddha kind of gives guidance, but then we have to go off and do it. And we have to find out what works for us. Now, after I went through this teaching, and I'm going to go through it for you, but I'm kind of going to give you, you know, a spoiler, my spoiler, which is we all have all these temperaments. And that's the way that I think, again, like kind of a modern view would be like, well, you know, none of us fit into just a box, one temperament. But it's kind of, these are kind of this way it's presented as well. There's just this, and it's very dry in that way. But I will say, I will agree that most of us also have tendencies, which so some of these temperaments or types will, you know, you'll relate to them more. You'll kind of go, yeah, that's kind of more me, or that sounds like something that I need to work with. So the first three are what are sometimes called the three personality types in Buddhism, and they relate to what are called the three poisons, greed, hatred, and delusion. So their responses to those tendencies and those qualities, which are, you know, really considered to be the most destructive, I mean, they're called poisons, you know, really the most destructive qualities that arise for us, greed, and lust, and craving, hatred, aversion, anger, jealousy, fear, and delusion, which is this kind of lack of awareness, lack of understanding, which sometimes is called ignorance. Just, I don't get it. I don't understand how the world works, or I don't understand the truth. So this first one, which is of course often addressed in Buddhism, which is desire. It's in this commentary. It's referred to the lustful temperament. But you know, we see this as operating on many levels. There's this kind of sort of sensual quality of lust, but there's also probably more importantly the mental quality of craving, which can be everything from a craving for sense pleasure to a craving for things, for objects, for possessions, or for control of things, or for people, for relationships, all the things that we want. Now, this teaching is originally designed for monks, so the lustful part, the sexual part, is very important for them because they're celibate, and so they're going to be dealing with their sexuality with no way to express it. The classic sort of antidote to this is reflecting on the unattractiveness of the body is what it is. And we see this in many of the texts, this is one of the most sort of un-American meditation practices around. You know? Like, you know, our culture is very much sort of a positive, think positive about your body, don't hate your body. And the Buddha's like, well, you know, if you really look at it, and it's like, you know, talking about phlegm and blood and bile and, you know, your different organs, you know. So, yeah, right. It's probably right. Ultimately, our bodies, I mean, we do cover up most of our bodies most of the time, even if the weather is warm. So that might be a statement of some kind. I'm not going to go too far with that. Because it's not that relatable for most of us. And it's interesting, I was looking at Venerable Inalio, who's a contemporary Buddhist monk who's done a lot of work with these texts. And he's saying that he was actually talking about the risks of this practice. I don't know if this is a true story, but it's a story that he found somewhere in the text that some bunch of monks got kind of overly into this unattractiveness of the body reflection, and to the point that they became completely disgusted with themselves and committed mass suicide. So he said, this is not a skillful way to practice the unattractiveness of the body. Because what we're trying to get at, we're not trying to be life negating. What we're saying is we're trying to not be attached to the body, right? And this is what we're really getting to. So my way of thinking about this, about working with desire, rather than talking about the unattractiveness of the body, is to think about the unsatisfactoriness of objects. I think this makes more sense for lay people, remembering that things and money and pleasures and possessions and relationships, that none of these things can give us ultimate satisfaction. So that we're, again, not that we're rejecting these things, as because they're all natural and part of our lives, but that we don't become so obsessed with them that this is all we pursue. And that's what so the antidote to this, when we find ourselves caught up, and it can be very often this, we're caught up in the mind, is to remember, you know, yeah, it'll be nice to have that new car, but it's just a car, you know. Or, yeah, it's going to be great to have dinner at this 5-star restaurant, but it's just a meal. And we just kind of just kind of get a perspective on it, remembering that it's not, none of these things are ultimate ways to satisfaction. So what's behind the unsatisfactoriness of objects is that everything is impermanent. Right? No matter what you get, is going to pass away. And that actually relates to all three of these first types, the lustful, the greed, hatred, and delusion types. And I'll kind of come back to that for each of them. But this reflection on impermanence is also really important, and the Buddha emphasizes it in relation to our connection to other people, our attachment to other people. The famous sutta, "Born from those who are dear," in which a father's only son has died, and he's going crazy. He's just out of his mind. He comes to the Buddha. He's just, asking the Buddha to solve this problem. And the Buddha says, this is just natural. Everything that we love is going to pass away, and you can't go crazy about that. It doesn't mean you're not going to grieve and feel great sorrow, but to not understand that is to not understand what is true, what is fundamentally true, that we can't hold on to anything. So this, when we practice meditation, and our practice is, to just try to be mindful of the breath, and then we find ourselves just lost and spinning out in fantasies or plans or desires. These are some ways that we can kind of put a perspective on them. Again, I really avoid this idea that we should get rid of certain types of thoughts or suppress them, but rather, it's much more about looking at their unsatisfactory quality, or just looking at them and holding them, so that we kind of lose the enchantment. This is the term that the Buddha sometimes uses, disenchantment. The mind becomes like something that's under a spell. We're under this spell of, if I just had that thing, when this happened, if I just could get that. And disenchantment is realizing, that's not going to solve my life. It's just something that would be helpful. Yes, I would like to have that, but not to be under this spell that we're going to be fixed by it. So this is a way we can respond. With mindfulness, mindfulness is always part of this process. So we're trying to be mindful, and then we see the mind keeps going to this place. So we need to see, with mindfulness, where is the mind going all the time? And one of the limitations of the idea of meditation practice as just let it go and come back to the breath is that you don't see what it is that you're letting go of. It's important to see what you're letting go of, or you're not really learning anything. All you're doing, you're doing something valuable, which is training the mind to come back and training the mind to settle. But that's only half the story, if that. So it's so important to see, now I'm really caught up in this. And then, if something is really taking over the mind, to then apply a reflection on it, apply a kind of antidote to it, so that you can defuse that. So the second temperament that's in these commentaries is the aversive temperament. They call it a hating kind of temperament. And the antidote for that is the four Brahmaviharas, kind of very popular teaching: loving kindness, compassion, sympathetic joy, and equanimity. And each of these plays a different role and operates in a different way. But they are fundamentally about cultivating positive mind states. So thus being an antidote to an aversive mind state. Metta, or loving kindness, cultivates an open heart, an attitude of kindness, looking for the best in others and in ourselves. It counters hatred of others, and it counters self-hatred as well, very important as a counter to self-hatred. And it also counters aversion to experiences or situations. So, you know, it's not just about people, but about, wow, how did I wind up here? And being able to kind of bring an attitude of kindness into a situation that you didn't really want to be in or you don't want to be in. Or again, in a moment of something unpleasant happening, to kind of bring back this positive thought. And so the thought, the kind of seed thought of loving kindness is, may you be happy. And you includes yourself. So may we be happy. So that's, loving kindness is very simple in that regard. It's kind of always applicable. Whereas compassion, or karuna, the second of the Brahmaviharas, is specifically meant to be applied towards people that are suffering. And that's what, we understand what compassion is. It is this expression of caring for those who are in difficulty and pain and mental or physical distress. But I think as an antidote to aversion, it works as a reminder that everyone suffers. So I was just reading an article in the New York Times about Erica Badu, who's a great R&B singer, and really an amazing article. I actually need to cut it out, or whatever one does now with a newspaper article, posted on Facebook, I guess, where she's practicing like radical compassion. And she's been attacked for talking about having compassion for a male R&B singer who's been accused of sexual assault. And people are like, you shouldn't have compassion for him. And she's like, no. You have compassion for everybody, even Hitler. And people are like, no, you can't have compassion for Hitler. But according to the Buddha, yeah, everybody deserves compassion, which is why it's so hard, you know, why it is associated with really the most spiritually advanced people, like the Dalai Lama, who's, you know, what he calls the Chinese, my friend's the enemy, which is like, what? I find this to be a really helpful guide. Again, when I'm caught up in my own agitation and aversion towards someone, to remember that they are human. And all humans suffer. Even if they, you know, I've said something like, you know, we should be compassionate towards billionaires. It's kind of the same thing. It's a different type of, and again, it's easy to think, well, what do you mean? They're billionaires. What kind of problems do they have? Well, guess what? They have bodies and minds. You know, where do you think your problems come from? They don't come from, from having money. Well, anyway, we'll discuss that. We can discuss that with our brokers later. Obviously, poverty is painful, but that doesn't mean wealth brings happiness. The you know, bringing compassion towards someone who's evil. You know, this is really difficult. And this is the Buddha really makes this point that another well-known sutta, the simile of the saw, where the Buddha says, even if bandits are sawing off your limbs one by one, if a thought of ill will arises in your mind, you're not practicing what I teach. Well, when we get that, we'll all be enlightened. So. And I take teachings like that. I take them literally, in a sense. I mean, I think the Buddha meant it, and I think that he's describing something that is possible. But I don't take it as a way of measuring myself. You know, I don't think that's helpful. You know, oh well, you know, I can't be that compassionate. I'm a bad meditator. I'm a bad Buddhist. You know, what's the point of that attitude? Because what is that? That's more. Oh, that's aversion for myself. You know, so that's not what he's trying to say. I take it as kind of a guideline, like just to be honest with myself. Well, these are the limits of my compassion. And yeah, I try to be as compassionate as I can, but this is the limit, and I forgive myself for that, for being imperfect. Because after all, I'm human, and so I'm imperfect. I'm not sure that the Buddha was perfect, you know. He gets kind of deified at times, but he did leave his wife and child, you know. He sort of slipped out there. Some people call him a deadbeat dad. I mean, I don't know. So, in any case, we have loving kindness, we have compassion. So then the third of the Brahmaviharas, there are four. Mudita, or sympathetic joy, is a term that we don't have language for in English, which is telling. I mean, it's one of the things that's interesting is to look at different languages that have certain words that, you know, aren't found in other languages, and obviously says something about the culture. So this idea of sympathetic joy is taking joy in the happiness of others. A very kind of generous attitude. And it's meant to be in the context of this aversive temperament, or it's meant to be an antidote to envy or to jealousy. And it's also, though, seen as a kind of appreciation. So sometimes it's called appreciative joy. So it's actually an entryway into gratitude in that way. Appreciating what we have, appreciating our lives as they are, and appreciating others, appreciating the people we care for. You know, and it's interesting, I can't remember where I've read this, I don't think this comes directly from the Buddha, but the idea that if you practice sympathetic joy, then there's always something to be happy about, because someone is always happy. Someone is always having some success. So the reflection, or the kind of phrase that goes with sympathetic joy, is may your happiness continue and may it increase. So these first three of the four Brahmaviharas are kind of cultivating these positive states, love, and then compassion, which is, you know, caring about suffering, and then sympathetic joy, hoping for people to be happy. And I'll say compassion and sympathetic joy are kind of opposites, not in a negative way, but compassion is responding to other people's suffering, and sympathetic joy is responding to other people's happiness, for what it's worth to notice. So the fourth of the Brahmaviharas is upekkha, or equanimity. And this is really distinctively different from the first three, because it's not so much kind of trying to be an uplifting experiences. It is, it's a balancing quality. And so it's, in terms of aversion, what I first thought of when I was sort of outlining this talk was that equanimity as an antidote is an antidote to despair. Because with equanimity, we get a broader view. We kind of get we hold like a broad view of things. We see the big picture. You know, our tendency is right to narrow and look at the good or the bad, and to kind of get, it's good, it's bad, you know, and kind of go up and down with those different things. And equanimity is kind of reminding us that, you know, there's good and there's bad. That's just the way things are. Things come and go. Don't get too attached to the good, and don't get too aversive to the bad, or even necessarily even see them as good and bad, because in what we call good, there can be something negative. In what we call bad, there can be something positive. And so upekkha then also is directly related to our recollection of impermanence. If we are too attached to the different, you know, mind states or different experiences in our lives as they come and go, it's the eight worldly winds, you know, gain and loss, pain and suffering. It's always up and down. And if we're buying into that all the time, if we're not remembering, oh, this is temporary, then we're, you know, getting blown around. It's the metaphor winds implies. So the other reflection from equanimity is about karma, is that things are the way they are because of causes and conditions. That things didn't happen by accident. Things happened because of causes and conditions. So we need to kind of have that understanding, and I would even say kind of belief that's how things work in order to have this balance. So in the practice of the Brahmaviharas, the equanimity is meant to help us to not be attached to the results of doing the other Brahmaviharas. So what that means is that, you know, you're practicing loving kindness for people, but it turns out like somebody you're sending love to is unhappy. So you think, oh, I must not be doing it right, or I'm not doing it well, you know, hard enough or enough, you know, I have to do more. Or, you know, we're sending loving kindness or compassion to someone and they're suffering, but they're not. Why aren't they getting well? I sent them, you know, compassion, right? So if we get attached to the results of that practice, then we're misunderstanding that. So the phrase that goes with upekkha is, all beings are the owners of their karma. Their happiness or unhappiness depends upon their actions, not upon my wishes for them. It's you know, kind of a good reminder. Again, it kind of going back to Analio's talking about people getting too into the unattractiveness of the body. If we get too into metta and think that, okay, I'm really doing it now, then we're kind of losing our balance with that. The upekkha also helps to balance us emotionally around these issues. With loving kindness, if we get attached to loving kindness, it turns into a kind of craving. If we get so caught up in compassion, it can turn into a grief, because if all we're looking at is other people's suffering, and you know, we get, there's kind of a burnout. if we get too caught up in sympathetic joy, there can be this sort of irrational elation. Or was it irrational exuberance? I think that was, what's his name, the Fed chairman's description of the bubble at the end of the 90s. But anyway, I digress. It's a good expression, irrational exuberance. So now, so we've covered the lust or greed type or temperament, the aversive temperament. So the third temperament is the deluded temperament. And interestingly, so the deluded temperament, it's a little hard to describe. It's kind of easy for us to understand desire and aversion. Delusion, sort of by its nature, is kind of vague. You know, it's kind of spacey. So the deluded type of person typically kind of is certainly gets easily confused and like sort of, you know, spaces out a lot, forgets where they are, so there's an example of the three types who walk into a party. So, and the greed type walks in to the party, and it's like, wow, look at all these people. This is great. Who am I going to talk to first? I think I'll have a drink of that. Let me have some of this to eat. And immediately they're all excited about the party. The aversive type comes in and goes, I don't know if I should have come. You know, I had a good show on Netflix. I could have stayed home. These people look kind of boring. The deluded type comes in and goes, wait, am I at the right party? Is there a party next door that I'm missing? So, interestingly, in this particular text, in this commentary, the antidote to the deluded type is mindfulness of death, which suggests that the deluded type doesn't understand impermanence. Kind of thinks, yes, this is great. It's like just going to go on like this forever. I'm going to live forever. Or maybe more generally, it's the deluded type is just kind of immature or naive. But what we can say is that, you know, more simply, the deluded type needs more mindfulness, right? Because it's really the delusion or that state of sort of being spaced out is really the opposite of mindfulness. So I think we can all start with mindfulness, but the deluded type needs to really kind of work at it. It's interesting here that, I mean, the Buddha brings up mindfulness of death, and it's, you know, this is something that's another kind of very central reflection in Buddhist teachings, and one that, again, our culture really has trouble with. It's just so interesting to see how, I tend to, you know, sometimes in just casual conversation, say things like something about death, or, oh, yeah, well, I'll probably die, you know, blah, 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 blah. I have kind of bad lungs. I think I'll probably die of, like, emphysema or lung cancer. You know, and people are like, why are you talking about that? Shouldn't be talking about dying. I'm like, why shouldn't I be talking about dying? I'm planning on doing it. I don't know. Might as well. Nothing wrong with it. I'm not embarrassed about it or anything. I'm not afraid of it. I'm afraid of pain. It's just, you know, this is another kind of element of our culture. We can see, in fact, that all of these qualities we're describing are cultural qualities as well, and that particularly this delusion. Delusion is kind of at the heart of our culture. Because delusion, another quality of delusion, actually, is that the deluded type doesn't realize that greed and hatred cause suffering. You know, that's the biggest delusion of all. Right? And, of course, the deluded type doesn't see impermanence. And so you're really completely missing the way things work. You're operating in kind of a whole other world that is not real. You know, a belief that, oh, if I get enough stuff, and if I get rid of all the unpleasant stuff, you know, I'll be happy forever. So this is why I kind of, you know, said initially that we have all these qualities. Each of us has these qualities. We can see in ourselves that we have elements of these. So the next three, the temperaments, are ones that I haven't really seen them before in other contexts of Buddhism. At least two of them I haven't seen. So. Interesting. The first one is called a discursive temperament, and the recommendation for working with a discursive temperament is to practice mindfulness of the breath, which suggests that we all have discursive temperaments, since that seems to be the practice that not only the Buddha emphasized, but virtually every Buddhist meditation teacher in history has emphasized mindfulness of the breath. So, again, I think this is relevant for everybody. I've never met anybody who didn't have discursive mind. And, yeah, that varies. Some people have more discursive thinking than others. But I'll say that the breath isn't the only antidote. I mean, it's kind of the classic one, but loving-kindness practice is a good antidote. And many forms of the Vipassana practice, like noting practice or the scanning of the body or counting the breaths or doing mantra. There are many ways to cut through the discursive mind. But this is coming back to this first question, if I could call it a question, of kind of mastery of meditation. One of the things we all try to do is to develop strong ways to interrupt discursive thinking. That's a lot of what our practice is focused on, because if we can't interrupt the discursive thinking, we can't even know that we're having aversive or lustful thoughts. So it's interesting that if I had created this list, I would have put this first, probably, on the list, discursive mind. Maybe next time I will make it my own list. But I do like to kind of follow the way it's offered. We have to be able to interrupt the thinking. And this, again, kind of goes to this question of, am I supposed to stop thinking? And that's not quite it. But we do have to interrupt our thinking, repeatedly. And when we interrupt it, then we see what's going on in the mind, and then we can do other skillful things. This is why meditation isn't such a simple process and really requires us to kind of develop these other skills. You can see I'm running out of time, so I'll get through these last two. So the fifth temperament that's described is the faith temperament. And this is where now this takes a bit of a different turn. So the faith temperament, I'll say it, the texts say that the way to work with the faith temperament is to do recollection of the Buddha. So recollection of the Buddha is kind of a devotional practice where you learn about all the different qualities of the Buddha, and there's lists. This is one of the things that you can find in the suttas or in the commentaries, kind of lists of all the qualities that the Buddha had, all his great qualities, his perfections and all that. And then you reflect on those qualities. And it's just kind of a way of, it's a very uplifting, but it's really a devotional practice, an expression of love. But what stood out for me about this practice is that the other practices that we've been talking about have all been antidotes to certain mind states. This practice, though, is a t- kind of taking advantage of this tendency. Oh, if you have a faith quality, well, you can kind of build on that, because it's the faith temperament is kind of seen as being having a positive quality to it. Faith types often, I think, are drawn to different religions than Buddhism. Buddhism doesn't tend to draw faith types as much. Hinduism draws faith types, Christianity, Islam, these are more faith-based religions. Buddhism isn't seen, the faith in Buddhism is more subtle and not as obvious. But certainly in Asia, particularly the recollection of the Buddha and devotion to the Buddha is a big part of practice. So the final temperament is called the intellectual temperament. It'll be one that all Westerners have to practice. And the practice that's recommended is called the four elements practice. So the four elements are earth, air, water, and fire, which are, the Buddha describes all material things are made up of these four elements. So this is kind of ancient. We find this in ancient Greek literature as well as ancient Buddhism. But it's a way of, from a meditative standpoint, it's a way of examining your experience of your body and categorizing the different experiences. So when the body feels heavy, it's the earth element. When a body feels hot, it's the fire element. When there's movement, it's the air element. And the water element is seen as cohesion, so the body is held together by water. That is, if you take all the water out of your body, you just turn into dust. That's actually how they cremate people now. They don't burn them, at least in the West, they just take all the water out. But the water element also, obviously, it's in our mouths and it's all through our bodies, but not as much, when we sweat. So it's interesting. I looked at this, and I tried to look for some other references. Mostly, so this is kind of, I can see why the elements practice is suggested for the intellectual, because it's kind of the type of practice that you kind of think about in a way. You kind of walk around. I mean, besides, if you're meditating, yeah, you can sit there and just feel those things and identify them, point to them. Oh, that's earth, that's air. But it's also applied, like if you're on retreat, you can start to, when you're walking around, just everything that you see and everything that you touch, see what its elements are. Oh, I'm walking through air, I'm feeling the air element, or it starts to rain, I'm feeling the water element. I'm walking on the earth, I'm feeling the earth element. That you're just kind of like pointing to the different elements. Still not convinced. I'm not convinced of it as a practice. I've tried it and I've never been able to get into it, but one of my teachers has definitely recommended it, and I've heard other teachers recommend it. I just don't quite see how you engage it like in a sort of absorbing way. It doesn't seem very absorbing. But I guess, again, I come back to it. It says it's for intellectual, so it does seem like it's just more in the head, which doesn't interest me very much. So just to go back briefly over these things, to think about when we're caught in a desire mind, to reflect on the unsatisfactoriness of the things that we desire. That they're just not, meaning they're not going to satisfy us. The delusion of desire is that I will get satisfaction from this once I get it. And so reflecting that that's not true. With aversion, trying to counter it by thinking either loving or compassionate, supportive or balancing sort of thoughts, responding to those feelings in whichever way kind of fits the experience. So if you're responding to anger, then cultivating love. If you're responding to suffering, cultivating compassion. If you're responding to envy, cultivating mudita. If you're responding to sort of imbalance or despair or any sort of extreme emotion, cultivating the equanimity. Mindfulness of death is always a recommended practice. It's this may sound perverse in some way, but you know, when you get into a car, every time you get into a car, your life is threatened. I mean, your life is always threatened. Bhikkhu Bodhi was once asked how he contemplated death, and he said, "Well, I just always imagine that there's someone walking around behind me, that the specter of death with the Grim Reaper, that he's walking around behind me, and at any time he could just chop my head off." So, okay, that'll keep you on your toes. And I think it's important to remember one of the reasons for contemplating death is to be fully alive, right? Like, don't waste this time. It's not like, oh, you should be afraid of death, or watch out, it's going to happen, you're going to get caught. But rather, you know, what are you doing with these few moments that you have of life? So that's the positive way of reflecting on mindfulness of death. So when you're spacing out and you're just in deluded mind, you know, to come back and go, wow, what am I doing? You know, let me remember the value of this life. And discursive mind of the breath, that's something we all are familiar with. Recollection of the Buddha. I think, you know, this is what we did with the chanting when we do Buddhang Saranang Gacchami. And we're really appreciating that, and that's something that can really be inspiring. And then the four elements, I'll leave that to you to figure out. You don't know what to do with that.